Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. And this is a bit of a weird show, I can tell you right now. Right now, as I speak, not as you're listening, because I don't know when you're listening, but as I speak, and actually that's not even exactly true, because what I mean is that as I'm supposed to be speaking here on Tuesday afternoon and evening here in Los Angeles doing the broadcast, right now I will actually be recovering from shoulder and elbow surgery that I had this morning. So I'm not in the studio at this moment. It's all weird now I think about it, because everything's time warped and location warped. But anyway, this is a kind of a special show that I'm doing in advance, so I don't leave you as orphans when I'm away for this planned medical leave, so to speak. By the way, it's nothing super, super serious. It's a torn rotator cuff in my left shoulder, and I got some really severe tendonitis in my left elbow. And the shoulder thing was meant to be taken care of anyway. And then when I got this bad tendonitis, which I thought was going to go away, and it never went away, and I had an MRI, and it looks like it's pretty severe. So they got some things they can do with that. At the same time, I'm under a general when they're working on my shoulder. So a couple days later, I'm sit in a chair for 3 or 4 days with a cold circulating compress on my left shoulder. I had that over 10 years ago on my right shoulder. It worked great. So I'll be doing that. And then after a few days, I will be convalescing and moving around a little bit more, but plenty of time to get out to Seattle reality in October. So no worries about all of that. Just let you know what's going on. And the reason why I want to do something that I've actually never done before on a show, and that is to hazard a sort of spiritual autobiography. Now, the hazard here is that you might misunderstand my intent. Let me explain what I have in mind. I think that it would be natural for you to be interested in some of the details of my own past. I'm glad to share some of those with you, as I often do here and there, just to fill in some of the blank spaces as you wonder about the path that led me to where I'm at now. But I'm really more interested in something else. I'm interested in you seeing something bigger. And that bigger thing is, I guess, simply put, is the hand of God. And I hope that what I have to say will help you to see that. The reason I put it that way is, as I look back at my almost 47 years, actually it will be 47 years by the time this broadcast airs, as I look back on all that time and on the multitude of adventures, the best way to put it, that I've been able to share in with the Lord and with other unbelievably wonderful Christian people, both servants and soldiers. And some of them are servant soldiers, and some are servant leaders. You know, it's, I continue to be taken by the obvious presence of the hand of God orchestrating the events that brought me to this particular stage of my life. By the way, I don't think I'm unique in that way. This is not at all what I mean to be suggesting. I think everybody's life is like that. And I think it's very easy for us to miss things because we don't reflect on the confluence of events in the past and their impact on the present. Instead, many of us are focused on what we think God is telling us to do in the moment. What is God telling me to do right now? How am I being led by the Spirit right now? Now, I think this is a complete misunderstanding of Paul's sense of what he meant by led by the Spirit, the two times in all the Scripture where the phrase is used like that, both by Paul, one in Romans 8 and one in Galatians chapter 5. He was talking about something different. He wasn't talking about feeling nudges by God to take you in a certain way. Oh, I think God's telling me to do this. I feel led to do that. That isn't what Paul had in mind. Frankly, if that's not what Paul had in mind, we shouldn't be using the language of Paul to describe something that he had not in mind. That's another issue, and many of you know my feelings about that. My thinking about that, it's not my feelings, and my convictions about that, having studied this issue many, many years. What I think really is more often the case is not God, quote unquote, leading in that sense, because I almost never have had anything like would fit that description, frankly. Rather, I think that in my experience is consistent with the biblical record, and that is that God takes us places. He doesn't lead us in that sense. It's not our subjective awareness of what we think he's hinting at us to do, and therefore we start doing it. It's rather God working sovereignly to accomplish his purposes, and we end up there. Now, I think he works with our sentiments in all kinds of different ways that he gets that done, but it doesn't require any skill of hearing from him. It does require a different skill of not exactly hearing, but understanding what he says, but that's in the written word that's available to every one of us. Okay, my mini sermon on that, just so you get my perspective on this. My life is a testimony to where God has taken me, and many times he was taking me in places I had no idea. There's almost nothing in my life, certainly as a Christian, that was ever planned out in the macro. It isn't like I said, well, I think I'll start this thing and have this big deal and have a lot of people working for me and travel the world and blah, 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 blah. There was a time when I watched my gifts develop and people express their observation of their fruitfulness in their lives. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is cool. I like this. It's working out pretty well. I'd like to do it more. And that had to do with me, simply put, talking, communicating in some fashion. This is the capability that I had and I've worked on developing as a steward, okay? And so I did think, okay, I can do this and I'm liking it and it's working, so I'd like to do more. So in a very general sense, I was interested in expanding my capability to use my spiritual gifting more effectively. But that's just a generalized goal, but by the way, that everyone should have in virtue of scriptural injunctions. 1 Peter 3 says simply, given that you have a gift, use it as a good steward by the grace of God in the power that the Holy Spirit gives. That's kind of general. What gift is that? Well, there's a lot more detail in 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, but I don't think the gifts are even limited there. Now, my whole approach has been something you've heard many times, bloom where you're planted, all right? And so that's what I've tried to do. And in the process of being faithful with what is in front of me, God has moved me many, many, many places, as I'll share with you here in a moment. Some of you know that, I was born in 1950, so that means during the chaos of the 60s, I was a teenager and in college, high school, 64 to 68, and then in college after that, I had a short stint in the military. Well, it was a short active duty, 69 to early 70 as an Army reservist. I got my basic training, and then I did weekend warrior for the remainder of my six-year commitment. 1968 to 1974 was my enlistment period, but I actually grew up in a church family, all right? And Incidentally, it does occur to me that what I'm doing here is giving my personal testimony, and I think there's a liability to doing that, particularly if during the Jesus movement, there was a lot of that. People got saved in radical ways, and so they gave their testimony, and there were all of these rock stars and drug addicts and convicted felons and former grand druids of Satanism becoming Christians. And it was all very glamorous, you know. And so, like, the rank and file think, wow, man, you want me to give my testimony at this little meeting or something? Yeah, but it's not that exciting. And so then there's a tendency to want to glamorize it a little bit and make it a little bit more radical than it actually was, you know. I heard one guy say once, he said, I don't give my testimony anymore. Well, why not? He said, well, I kept adding to it. I couldn't remember how I did get saved, you know, kind of thing. So I'm not going to add to it. I'm just going to try to tell you the straight scoop. And I wasn't a rock star or a drug addict or a convicted felon or a former grand druid in Satanism or anything like that. I had a different liability. And I think everybody has something that is who is not a Christian, who is resisting Christianity. There is something that is front and center for them. Okay. Now, behind the scenes, we know what's going on. It's a rebellious heart that wants to do its own thing. All right. To revive a phrase from the 60s. We just want to be in charge. We want to be a captain of our own ships and our, you know, master of our own fates and all of that stuff. We don't want anyone telling us what to do. And some of us have that affliction more aggressively than others, but it's there in all of us, all right? It's the original sin, quite frankly. And but that's not the thing we're aware of. Oh, I don't want God because I want to be in charge. Some people will actually say that, but that isn't what's front and center. Instead, we sanitize it in a different way with some other kind of thing that makes it look more justified. And in my case, I mean, to put it simply, I thought I was too smart to be a Christian. You know, I was I thought all Christians it's a little embarrassing to say this now, but I thought all Christians were either dumb or ugly. They were too dumb to think for themselves, and so they had some other religious person think for them. Or they were just too socially unacceptable to kind of make it in the world, and so they went to the church where everybody had to accept you because that was one of the rules, love one another. There it was in the back of the church, you know, well, a big banner there. So that was the rule, okay? And that was the appeal. By the way, it is the appeal, and it's a legitimate appeal of one another. We see that environment often in churches, characteristically, I think, in churches. But for me, that was just a weakness, and I didn't want anything to do with that. And by the way, I thought I had actually tried Christianity because I had been raised in a church environment with religious instruction. My family was Roman Catholic, and we filled the pews for our requisite 52 Sundays a year, plus the extra 8 or 9 days that were required by that faith, the holy days of obligation, as they were, which, by the way, included Christmas and New Year's, which was the circumcision. 8 days after the birth of Jesus, you have the circumcision. And so that was celebrated 8 days after Jesus. It was a holy day of obligation. It was like Sunday for us. We had to go. It was a mortal sin. It was like the worst category of sin if you didn't go to church on Sunday. And that meant getting at this rote service by a certain time in the service, and you couldn't leave until another time. Of course, the deal was because nobody liked to go to church. And so you try to get there as late as you can and still qualify for the service and leave as early as you can kind of deal, you know. Go in peace. And everybody says, thanks be to God. And for us, that was like, thank God, we're out of here, you know, and then we go. And if Christmas was on a Saturday or a Monday, that was a bummer because then we had 2 days of church in a row for 2 weeks, Christmas, church, Sunday church, circumcision, another Sunday church. So like like five times a year. We had it back to back twice in a row. Unbearable. Anyway, there's a lot of people who are listening to me who know exactly what I'm talking about. And so we did our deal. And I was, you know, fully convinced in a certain sense. Maybe the best way to put it is I was fully socialized into the idea that the Roman Catholic Church was the true church. And I had kind of the standard comments I would make and that people make nowadays. And I would offer these to other people who I knew when I was in high school who were also Christians. I mean, pretty much everybody went to church that I knew. It was a very, much more religious culture than it is now. And, you know, everybody goes to church, you know, but you're going to the wrong one. The true church is my church. And then I gave the reasons why, my rote reasons that I had learned in catechism, and I actually went to parochial school for 4 years. So before public school, and public school, I was catechized and et cetera, et cetera. So, but then when I was 17, now this is 1967, so the war has just started, 3 years from Kennedy's assassination. By the way, I was 13 when John Kennedy was killed. I was 17 when Martin Luther King was murdered. Also the same year, that spring, when Bobby Kennedy was murdered. That was back-to-back, just a couple of months away from each other. I was 19 with Woodstock, okay? I was there through the entire – the Beatles came on the scene when I was 14 years old. This is my growing up period. And the whole counterculture revolution, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, the all of the radical groups like the Weathermen and SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, so-called Democratic. These were all radical, what we would call now terrorist groups, really, that were radicalizing the culture, driven on by an anti-war sentiment. And I was in many riots during that time. I wasn't really a trasher. I didn't like blowing things up or burning things down. I definitely was against the war, even though I was in college. I mean, in the Army. Weird. But I was fulfilling my own obligation. I didn't want to go overseas and fight. So I was a reservist, and luckily I didn't get activated. But nevertheless, these were my sentiments. You know why? Because I was a college student. College students move in packs. Intellectually in packs, and it's very difficult to break ranks. They are powerfully socialized to the ethos of that community. It was true then, it's true now. Issues are different, but the dynamic is still the same, and so I was a product of that, okay? And having this Roman Catholic background gave me the illusion that I had actually tried Christianity, and I, and by the way, when I say that, this is not a put down on Roman Catholicism, because this is true of people in Protestant denominations as well. That is, they're raised superficially in a Christian environment, and then they reject their superficial experience. And so I did that. I did reject that when I was 17. I remember my girlfriend's sister asked me a question. She was a couple of years older, and she was the worldly wise person and didn't believe all this mumbo jumbo. You know, I think she was an atheist. In any event, she said, as I was making my case for Roman Catholicism, she asked me a very important question. She said, "Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that?" By the way, that's a good question. That's Columbo right there. I never thought of it that way. And it stopped me in my tracks. And then I had to reflect to myself, am I expressing my own convictions or am I responding with what I have been socialized for so many years to say? And that's a good question to ask nowadays. It's the first time this has ever come up for me, this moment, but I just realized, what a great question. And it forced me to assess. And when I assessed, I realized, no, I did not believe this. And that was it. That was the end of Roman Catholicism for me at the moment, and that was the end of Christianity for me, insofar as I connected the two together, one and the same. Okay? And then I was off, and I want to tell you something. There was a tremendous sense of freedom that I experienced as a result of that. Unbelievable sense of freedom. Okay, because I was now throwing off my what I thought was my religious shackles, all the things that I didn't like, going to church and all the holy days of obligation and doing the things and living by the strictures that I think now many times were our artificial moral strictures of the Roman Church. That is, there's a whole bunch of obligations that were piled on me that are not genuine biblical moral obligations. And to be able to throw off those shackles was really great. Okay? And it was just the right timing because I was a young man on the threshold of discovery at 17 and 18 years old and 19 years old, and my mind was growing and my hormones were flowing. And let's just face it, this is a time in life when young men don't want to think about religion and God and purity or virtue, all right? And I was becoming more and more immersed in a countercultural revolution that encouraged that kind of rejecting of the old things and embracing a whole bunch of new things. That seemed really cool at the time. Incidentally, I was born in Chicago, grew up most of my life in Chicago at that point in the suburbs, except for the first 5 years that I spent on a farm in northern Wisconsin. My dad wanted to be a farmer, so right after Susan and I were born, Susan is a year and 2 weeks older than I am, soon after I was born, we moved to Andego, Wisconsin. My dad wanted a farm. That's potato farming country up there. We had some dairy cattle, and he worked at a fertilizer plant. And we lived in this old clapboard house that did not have a bathroom. So my first 5 years, we had an outhouse, okay, with Sears Roebuck catalog in it. You know what that's for, TP. And we had chickens running around. We wanted chicken dinner. My mom would grab a chicken, whack its head off. It would fly around the barnyard for a while. She'd pluck the feathers and cook a chicken. That's why we had chicken dinner, okay. And on Good Friday 1955, just 2 months before my fifth birthday, the whole place burned down. Middle of the night, fire raging. We woke up. Cat was meowing loudly. Mark was 2 years old, I think. David had just been born, my younger brothers. Bonnie was not yet on the scene. And we just got out of that building, and it burned right down to the foundation. All the money that my dad had on his dresser, the change, melted into a clump. That was gone. His dream for Wisconsin and a cabin was gone, and so he moved back to Chicago and started all over, declared bankruptcy, and began again. Four kids and one on the way. Bonnie was number five. My folks had five kids inside of, five inside of 7 years or 8 years. One, two, 7 years. That was a tight shot pattern. By the time my folks were 27, they were done having kids. They had five, and with four on the floor kind of thing, you know. I mean, it was really hard for them. And my dad was bankrupt and everything. So that was kind of the environment that I grew up in Chicago. So back to now I'm 17. I'm on my own. That I was one of those guys who left home pretty early. And I went off to Northern Illinois University, then off to Michigan State University, where my high school sweetheart was at. We were like 4 years into our relationship from 70 to 72. I was there at Michigan State in East Lansing. I was part of the prestigious Honors College at the time. I could choose my own program of study. I could construct it. I guess it's not so unusual anymore, but it was then. And I could waive all the standard requirements, and I was studying pre-law social science, and that was my direction. And I had left the Christianity thing behind. I was active, in the anti-war movement. Let's put it this way. I wasn't active like I was a member of an organization. I was just sympathetic like everybody else. And I've been in many, many marches. I was gassed many times. I was actually in a huge huge riot in 1970 in Grant Park in Chicago in the summer there. And that was massive. And cars were burning everywhere. And I pulled a young man out of the bushes who had been shot in the chest. Because of my military training, I was able to help patch him up, a sucking chest wound, and get him off to the hospital. But this was all part of the crazy 60s stuff. And not only was there anti-war movement, a whole flood of new ideas were entering my world, and I wanted nothing to do with a restrictive killjoy God of Christianity. Like I said, I wanted to be captain of my own fate, master of my own life, and this did give me a wonderful sense of freedom initially. Now, the 60s were a very unique time. It spawned such phrases as, now think about these. I mean, they sound corny now. But do your own thing, whatever turns you on, live for today. By the way, that was a line of a popular song, fa la 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 la, live for today. If it feels good, do it. Different strokes for different folks, and other embarrassing terms like groovy and funky and far out. Okay. And the idea there was, notice all the relativizing kind of statements. It's up to you to decide how you want to live. Okay. And boy, did I buy that lock, stock, and barrel. Okay. Because I wanted to live the way I wanted to live. And here was a whole culture that was telling me it was okay to live the way I want to live. Now, I want you to see something. I was not consistent with this at all because I was marching against the war in Vietnam. And on the one hand, though aspects of my moral life were unrestrained because I could do my own thing, whatever turns you on, if it feels good, do it, live for today. It's groovy and it's funky and it's far out. I was still marching against the war in Vietnam. Why? Because it was an immoral war. Why wasn't I just letting, like Johnson and Nixon do their own thing? Why wasn't I just letting the soldiers live for today, you know? Why wasn't I letting the military do whatever turned them on? You see, those things were great for me personally, but what it amounted to, not for other people who did things I didn't like. Well, then I got the moral argument against them. Now, notice the contradiction. And I talk about that kind of thing today with regards to today's culture. But that was me. And I was aware at the time that there was a conflict between my moral relativism and my moralizing about the Vietnam War, and maybe other things too. But that was one of the obvious ones. And I was aware of it, and it gave me pause. And I thought, wow, this is different. What about that, Kokel? And to be honest with you, I didn't worry about it very long. I simply brushed it off because there was a payoff for me, and the payoff was if I just ignored the apparent contradiction, I could live the way I wanted. I could do what I wanted to do in terms of my own personal moral life, but I could also do what I wanted to as a part of a larger community that walked in lockstep. The youth and the college environment and all of that. And even though we were rugged individualists, we all thought alike. We aren't going to go along with the conventions, and we all conformed to the conventions of our community, which was what I would call now the political left. I was part of that. Now, I was willing to live with those inconsistencies because of the payoff. Okay. And this goes back to something I mentioned earlier, the real problem with human beings, and that's rebellion. And I think many intelligent people make the same kind of fundamental mistakes I was making and thinking when it comes to spiritual things. I've said this many times. They don't want to bend the knee. That's what's going on. Okay. And we'd rather live with an irrational view of life than come to our senses. Quite literally. In other words, believe the sensible thing, the reasonable thing. and bend the knee, because we don't want to bend the knee. So everything's flowing on along nicely. Now I'm in this, you know, mid 70 to 72, I was in Michigan State University till the summer. And right around that time, this is when my relationship with my high school sweetheart began to deteriorate. Now, she was just finishing up. She got her degree. The goal that we both had was to move to California, the mystical land. It was like a foreign country. People who don't – most of you are listening understand this, but people who are raised in California don't. That when you live in the Midwest, you think of California. You don't even think of – you think of a different country. It's like Middle Earth. It's so exotic. It's so odd, unusual, different, and appealing. And so to go there would have been great. And I couldn't believe when I finally moved to Southern California, living in Southern California. But at the same time I was making that move, actually just before I left, I realized that this relationship was coming to an end. And this was absolutely devastating for me, okay? When my girlfriend of 6 years, my first love, left me, and my world came tumbling down around me. And here is the thing that really impressed me about that time. It wasn't like, now I'm in a hole, now I'm going to reach up for God, foxhole Christianity. That is not what happened with me. What I realized is all of these philosophies that I had embraced, right? All of these crazy little self-serving ideas that were popular in the day did me no good when the chips were down. They did not help me. All it did was emphasize my aloneness. And there was no God that cared about me. I wasn't part of a greater scheme of things. I had some sense about some kind of a spiritual power, maybe like a Star Wars thing or something like that, or a yin and a yang and, pervasive God force throughout whatever that was. But, you know, those things are so general that what do they do for you? They make you feel good when you feel good. They make you feel better when you feel good. And some people got lifted up because they're told they're really God, and so that makes them feel better when they're feeling bad. But it's just not true. I wasn't God. That's why my life was miserable at that moment. Everything had come crashing down, and I couldn't get out. I just had to weather it. I called it cosmic alienation. It's curious. I still have writings from that time, and I can reflect back on how my mind was working when that all took place. And so what I was left with my philosophies was despair and nihilism and cosmic alienation. That is, in the entire universe, I was alone. There was no one who understood, that no one who ultimately cared. There was no grand design that I was fitting into that brought meaning and substance to my life. The things that brought meaning into my life was that relationship, and now it was gone. Now, meanwhile, back at the ranch, so to speak, back in Chicago, my younger brother Mark, by the way, we had all left Christianity, or I should say Catholicism, when we became teenagers, old enough to think for ourselves. And when we left, my folks left as well. There was no real pursuit of that anymore, and which shows there was no depth at all. It was just a thing we did when we were kids, and now we're grown-ups, okay, or a thing my parents did when they had kids and now they didn't. And so Mark was no different. Mark was 2 years my junior, but he had actually become a Christian. Huh? Yeah, the Jesus movement. That was happening even in the Midwest. And when I'd go back home to visit, I was on my own. I'd left home. I'm paying for my own education. I'm making my own way through life. I got nothing from my parents after I was 18 years old. Nothing, not a dime. I didn't get a signature on a loan, anything like that. They didn't pay for my car insurance, you know, buy my gas, you know, nothing like that. I was all completely on my own, and I made my own way. And there was Mark, though, and he was believing in this religious stuff, and I was the only guy in our whole family to go to college, really, a little few shots at local community college, but nobody persevered in that. But I went to state schools. I was on scholarship, actually. And so I figured I was too smart for that, as I told you. And Mark, well, he was the jock of the family. And so I just figured, oh, well, Mark needs that kind of thing. And so I just kind of brushed him off. But now I'm in a little different situation. Now I have moved to California. Even though this relationship was coming apart, I thought I could get to California and I could repair things. And she was living in Los Angeles. I first moved to Berkeley, and I stayed there for a couple of months. And then I went down and moved to Southern Cal, you know, hoping against hope that I could change things with her. But my brother Mark was also in Southern Cal at the time because I was there chasing a skirt. You know, that's how I got to the West Coast. He was running from the feds because he had gotten drafted. And he didn't want to go to war, and so he lit out for California. And, you know, he's scooping ice cream at the 31 Flavors in Long Beach, and the feds are knocking at the door, my mom in Chicago, and because my folks got divorced right after we all got out of high school, most of us. And you know, he's laying low, which I thought was a little weird because he's the Christian guy, but now he's running from the law, as it were. And he ended up making it right with them and turning himself in. And I took him to the induction center. I thought it would be all over, but apparently he had an ulcer. Maybe it's because he was so worried about the feds arresting him that they gave him a medical deferment. So, and he's praising the Lord. And I'm thinking, hey man, don't give me that praise the Lord business. In any event, I'm there with him now in Southern California, and so we get to meet on a fairly regular basis. We didn't really have vehicles back then, but he was living in Long Beach. I was up at West End by UCLA, and I was going to school there. And I've just, you know, we talked more about this, and he just would not let me go. Man, time and time and time, he'd be every time we got together, he wanted to talk about Jesus. And sometimes he told me the good news, and sometimes he told me the bad news. And he wasn't particularly clever. I didn't know about apologetics. He didn't know about apologetics. He was just giving me the straight scoop, okay? And what was really significant, what stood out for me, is that he was giving me a message that I'd never heard in church. Now, some people who are Roman Catholic now will take exception to this, but I'm just telling you what happened to me, and this is true with a whole bunch of other Roman Catholics that I've met. I never heard about grace. And in fact, the way things are structured theologically in the church, they actually work against grace. I mentioned that not going to church was one of the most bad sins you could commit. And that's called a mortal sin. If you have not confessed a mortal sin, you go directly to hell when you die. And unless you go to confession, and then you can kind of get that squared away on Saturday, but there's a whole lot of things that are mortal sins. And very easy to commit one, which means the minute you commit one, you're in at risk of going to hell if you die before you can either go to confession with a priest, do the requisite penance, or say a sincere act of contrition, which is a prayer of contrition. And I remember writing as a kid thinking, I'm going to keep my eyes out in case my dad is about to crash. And if he's about to crash in something, which might kill me, because this is before seatbelts, then I can rattle off a really fast, though sincere, act of contrition and cleanse my soul of mortal sins and then be on my way to heaven. Of course, you got to stop at purgatory first, but still, nevertheless, it wasn't going to be terminal in purgatory. I'd eventually make it to heaven. So this is the experience of a lot of Roman Catholics. It turned out to be really a works-based salvation, and there was no confidence that you could ever be sure that you would go to heaven. And this is why this is why the message that my brother was communicating to me of grace was so different. You could actually know you were going to heaven, huh? No, I'm not that good. No, it's not because you're that good. It's because Jesus is that good. It's because of what he did That eternal life is not something you get. It's something in the future when you die. It's something you could have right now. And I had never heard that before. And little by little, it began to sink in. And I wish I could say, well, here's the argument he gave me that really turned my head and it stopped me in my tracks. But there was nothing like that. There were no apologetics. It was just the gospel that kept coming at me relentlessly from my brother. And when I say relentlessly, I don't mean that he was totally obnoxious, but he was just consistent with me. And he would tell me about the grace of God. He would also tell me that there was something to be lost, that there was judgment. And boy, that the Catholics got that right. Okay, but I could be rescued from that. I could know that I could be rescued from that. That God had made a provision for me by placing all of my guilt on Jesus so that I could be pardoned. Jesus paid the price. That means I didn't have to pay. That means I could be forgiven. There's a simple calculus there. Now, I remember one time Mark saying to me, Greg, these things are true. Sooner or later, you're going to find that out. I just hope that when you do, it won't be too late. Now, that communicated an unbelievable sense of confidence that he had in the truth of the gospel. And it had an impact on me. It was more confidence than I had about things. And I found myself now turning this Jesus thing over in my mind time and time again. I keep coming back to this thing. And I found myself, wow, think about this, thinking more about Jesus than I was thinking about my old girlfriend. And in the summer of 1973, I was at the end of my commitment with the U.S. Army Reserve. And we have a summer camp 2 weeks. You play soldiers for a couple weeks at a camp somewhere. I was at Fort Lewis, Washington, and talking with another soldier who was a Christian. And he was amazed that I was interested. I'm asking him questions about his Christianity. And so I went out in a field at Fort Lewis, Washington, and I said a prayer. It was a very simple prayer. It's a prayer that actually a lot of people have prayed. And the prayer was, God, if you're real, I want to know. Show me if you're real. It was something to that effect. But I will tell you this, that I started to pray that by myself, kind of looking up into the sky, just saying this thing. And I stopped myself in the middle and I said, this is silly. You're just talking to the sky. In any event, I finished the prayer. I said, okay, well, here's the deal. Even though I thought I was a little crazy, I still prayed the prayer. And it wasn't much of a prayer. It was just talking to God the only way I knew how, that didn't start out Hail Mary or Our Father. All right. But that prayer seemed to unleash the hound of heaven on my heels. Now I look back at it now. I know he was always on my heels. But after that, everywhere I turned, it seems like I was confronting Jesus. And I just find these things, for example, in strange places. I'd see these Southern California, I'd see these posters. Some of you old enough might remember the big poster in Anaheim near Disneyland on the 5 freeway. There's Jesus knocking at the door of your heart kind of deal. Well, at one point, I was going to the grocery store getting groceries, and that's when they had paper, no plastic. Then I had my paper bag with all my groceries in it that I'd carried up to my apartment. I was unloading it, and there in the bottom of my bag was a tract. Okay, now these were very popular. They're still around in many different forms nowadays. But the most popular kind there were little booklets of stories or accounts or appeals that were developed by Jack Chick, C-H-I-C-K. That's why they were called Chick Tracks. And this particular one, I have an example of this in my hand. This particular one was titled Creator or Liar, and it was one of those that kind of gives the whole story. It starts in the very beginning. It talks about God creating things and then moves through the fall and then the destruction and then the flood and then the call of Abraham and the prophets and then Jesus, the Lamb of God, coming. And I mean, I'm just turning the pages right now, looking at it, and here's what Jesus did. He grew up, was without sin. He taught men to love one another. He healed the sick, et cetera, et cetera. But then at the end, it has the end of the story, right? It says, the Bible says that the lost shall be cast into a lake of fire. And here they've got a picture of the abyss. You know, it's black and white kind of thing. It's just a tract, but there's an angel like drop kicking people over the edge into the abyss, the lake of fire that was prepared for the devil and his angels and all that serve Satan instead of God, which is a paraphrase of Revelation 20. But on the other hand, all those who believe that Jesus died for their sins and repent and serve him will go to heaven, enter into the joy of the Lord. And I turn the page. I mean, I'm really, this thing is smoking at this point. In fact, I got to this page where all the people are being kicked into hell, and I put it down. I started unloading my groceries more because I was shaken by this. And then I pick it up and I read a little bit more, and then I put it down and I'm going back to my groceries. But I did manage to get to the last page. Here's what it said. Today, many claim Jesus was a liar. You must decide. If he was a liar, forget it. But if he is who he claims to be, your decision will determine where you will spend eternity. Wow. That got me. Because it laid it all on the line. The good news, the bad news, what's at stake. Now, that was another one of those little steps to the summer of 1973 that set me up for September 28th, a Friday night, in my apartment. Mark came up from Long Beach to visit me. We were spending the weekend together, hanging out, doing whatever. And he started talking to me more about Jesus. And I told him that night, I said, Mark, you don't have to tell me any more about Jesus. I've already decided I want to become a Christian. And that night I prayed a simple prayer and I committed myself to Christ. I didn't just receive salvation. Somehow I had the sense that this was a sea change for me. I was going in one direction. Now I am adopting and believing in and trusting in an individual Jesus and a whole set of concepts that go along with it. Let me just say that again. I am believing in Jesus, an individual who did something vital for me. I'm putting my trust in him, but that entails a whole world view that has implications for my behavior that went along with that. A lot of people nowadays, Jesus is cool, he's great, he's full of love and acceptance and everything and all kinds of movements where people want to do their own thing and get Jesus on their side and say Jesus was loving, so he'd approve of all of these things that Jesus thought was sin. And they think, oh, cool, I could be a Christian and not let go of any of these things. Not accept the whole package that Jesus represents. It isn't easy believism. It's a new way of life. It's a trajectory according to the Spirit, not according to the flesh, to use Paul's language in Romans chapter 8. All right? I understood that. And that started a radical change in my life. In fact, the very next day, we had scheduled a barbecue with a neighbor who was my doubles partner. He was a med student at UCLA along with his buddy who is a med student. They were both married. And those two couples and Mark and I went down to the beach and we went body surfing. We came back, had a barbecue at their house. And Mona, the wife of the other med student, pulled out a tract, like one of those chick tracts that she had found on the beach or somebody had given her. It was about Jesus. And she started reading it disparagingly, mocking it, making fun of it. Now, I'm a new Christian. I am not even 24 hours old in Christ. But I'm with Jesus now. And I couldn't sit there and just listen to this. Now, Mark was with me. He's the more mature Christian. He's 2 or 3 years older in Christ. But I announced, well, I believe that. And every jaw except for Mark's hit the floor. And especially my doubles partner, tennis doubles. He couldn't believe it. I'd never said anything to him about this. And they were all utterly hostile to Christianity. And so what ensued was about, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours of discussion that was so intense. By the time I got back to our apartment, I had the worst migraine that I had ever had. And I got all kinds of resistance. In fact, I never saw my doubles partner, I played tournaments with him, ever again in my life. Now, I did see his wife, who was kind of quiet, moving around in the background. She wasn't participating in this because years later, 5 years later, she found me, contacted me, and asked me to come see her because now she was divorced. And by the way, so was Mona and her husband divorced. Both of those marriages had failed. And she was by herself. And she told me, you know, that night you were talking, my first day in the Lord, you know that night you were talking about Jesus? Everybody else was yelling at you, but I was listening. And 5 years later, she became a Christian. You never know. At least Strobel calls this ricochet evangelism, right? But you never know what's happening, who's listening. In any event, I started walking with the Lord. And I have to tell you about an event, and I think what I'm going to do is then save this is all the BC and stuff, and I want to give the AD stuff probably in the next broadcast. But I want to tell you something that's really, really important that set the stage for every single thing that happened afterwards. In other words, after I became a Christian. And it's something that happened to me before I was a Christian. It was that summer of 73. I was there in the West End. I didn't have a car. I took a bus to the beach, Santa Monica Beach, and I was body surfing there, and I was on my way back. Now, I probably should say this. I looked like everybody else in my age group that time. I had hair down to my shoulders. I was blue jeans, kind of blue work shirt, but they call them a chambray shirt now. You know, it's just, I was hip, you know, I was cool. I was just one of the young crowd, you know. My hair was all blonde, believe it or not, because I was playing tennis a lot. And so that's the deal. And I'm in the car and I'm reading some Fritz Perls book, Gestalt Therapy Verbatim, because I was a student at UCLA studying psychology at the time, third, fourth psychology. I was all into all of that stuff. And, the gal in front of me is reading the Bible, but she's cute. And so I lean over and start making a conversation with her, you know. But she didn't want to, she wasn't interested in me the way I was interested in her. She wanted me to know Christ. And so she's telling me about Jesus. And I'd heard this before because they, oh, yeah, you and my brother would make a good team. You know, that's what I told her. But one of the, her name was Adrian Thatcher. Don't ask me why I remember her name, but I'm glad I do. Because of the impact she had in my life. This was probably July or something when I became a Christian in September 28th. So I'm in July. It's still a couple months off. And she's telling me about Jesus and carrying on. And then she tells me about a Bible study that she is participating in. It's in Westwood Village. And it's a Bible study at a place called like the Lighthouse or something like that. I didn't know what – that's all I recalled at the time. And the guy who led the Bible study was a guy named Hal Lindsey, who wrote a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Now, I thought it was an ecology book because I had read The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, and I was familiar with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and things, tomes like that that were really popular during that time and part of the burgeoning and blossoming environmental movement. So I thought, well, this is the late great planet Earth, right? But I paid no attention to that, really. It seemed to me like water off a duck's back. And her stop for the bus was actually right near mine. We were broadly in the same neighborhood. So I said, okay, I'll get up and I'll walk you home. You know, hope springs eternal, right? And so I walk her to her door in her apartment and she opens the door, turns around to me and says, thank you very much. Goodbye. Walks in, shuts the door. And I never saw her again in my life. However, a few months later, when I became a Christian, I remembered Adrian Thatcher's comment, and I think my brother Mark, being aware of what she had said, because I shared the occasion with him, he said, you ought to find out that where that Bible study is, because that would be good for you to get into fellowship, you know. And so I said, all right, well, I'll think about that. I'm walking through Westwood Village. And there is a storefront off to the side on one of the side streets. I'm looking at – it's a bookstore. I'm looking at the books. They're all religious books. No, actually, what I saw first was something on the window, and it said, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's what I read. And so what? I'm looking now at the books in the window, and they're all religious books. They're Christian books. Oh, my goodness. It was Logos Bookstore. I went down the steps into this small bookstore. Young lady there, who I later learned to be her name, Bonnie Bretz. And she, I said, is this a Christian bookstore? She said, yes, it is. I said, hey, I'm a Christian. Wow. You know, and there's one of those crazy, crazy, crazy responses. And she said, oh, that's great, blah, blah, blah. And I said, by the way, I heard about some Bible study here in Westwood area at a place called the Lighthouse or something. Do you know anything about that? She said, oh, you mean the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse. I said, yeah, that sounds like it. Do you know about it? You do know about it. She said, I live there. In other words, this was a Christian community that lived in a basically in an old fraternity house, two blocks off of campus, that had been converted into a Christian school, with women living up downstairs and the men living upstairs, and in between were meeting rooms and a cafeteria type thing where we ate food and stuff like that. And so, wow, okay. Well, I went to that Bible study the next Wednesday night, and here were all of these hip Christians and a lot of other people from the community gathered in this place, filling the entire venue, which wasn't very big, probably 100 people there, maybe 125, but it was really small. It was like a really, really big living room and foyer, and people were stacked like cordwood in there to hear the best-selling author of the entire decade, Hal Lindsey. And that was the first time that I'd ever heard a Bible teaching or a presentation. And so I attached myself to that community of the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse. And I came every week to that Bible study until I finally decided in February, the beginning of February 1974, I wanted to be part of that community. And I joined up. I moved in. I quit my schooling at UCLA, and I started my studies there at the J.C. Light and Powerhouse with all those wonderful Jesus movement Christians, numbering about 120 total. Some of them lived off campus. But that was a move that I made that absolutely changed everything in my life. And when I pick up in the next broadcast, I'll tell you what happened from there. It's an amazing story, and ironically, it is all launched by a casual remark made by a non-Christian to me by a girl who I was hitting on before I even knew the Lord. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye.